Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
This is your host, Stone Payton, and joining me in the studio this morning is our producer, Lee Cantor, and my good buddy, Todd Schnick. What's happening, Todd?
Not much, Stone. How are you doing?
I am doing well and looking forward to getting on with our trip this week.
Have you finished packing yet?
No, not yet.
Yeah, I haven't even started.
Headed to Orlando. We've got a full slate of authors to interview. We're going to be doing these authors' perspective interviews, and we're going to blog from the road and tell our folks all about it.
We're going to be travelogging and telling that story and getting pictures of Stone with Mickey.
Yeah, but we better get busy this morning. We've got a studio full. First up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning is Sharon Drew Morgan. She's written a new book that I believe is being released just this week called Dirty Little Secrets, and there's more to the subtitle, and we'll let her tell you all about it in just a moment. Welcome to the show, Sharon Drew.
Good morning, and my book was released Thursday, and it was number one on the Amazon Hot Picks and number one on the sales and marketing area. I'm excited.
Well, I'll bet you are. We're excited to hear more about it. Tell us about the subtitle and what this book is all about.
The subtitle is Why Buyers Can't Buy and Sellers Can't Sell and What You Can Do About It. It's a little long, but maybe fun. All of my other books have talked about this buying facilitation model that I've developed that actually leads buyers through their decision-making, leads anyone through them. But in this book, I decided to go really deeply into how buyers and how everyone really make their behind-the-scenes decisions, sales or coaching or negotiating, but we can talk sales, really only focuses on the solution placement end of the decision-making. So in coaching, for example, it focuses on the change that they're looking for. No model, especially a sales model, does not manage the behind-the-scenes issues that have to be addressed so that buy-in occurs for a new solution. Sales doesn't handle that. So this new book I have goes deeply into all of the issues, the systems, the change issues that have to be managed internally, and then it gives sellers a whole new set of skills, not sales skills, different ones, that actually help the buyer or help their three-year-old make a new decision that's more in alignment with reaching excellence and hopefully with the seller's solution.
Now, do these kinds of skills come naturally to a lot of folks, or is it something that they really have to learn, have to be taught?
I have Asperger's. I have nonverbal learning disorder, which makes me slightly more appropriate than I would be otherwise, although sometimes I certainly can have my own personal issues at a party. So my head thinks in systems. I always hear two strands coming through. I listen for systems. I know what's going on behind the scenes because I feel it, I hear it, I taste it, I touch it. That's part of who I am. And what I realized early on was that my ability to do that helped me help people make better decisions. It took me maybe a decade to figure out how to code it all, so that I could replicate it and then design programs to teach others how to do that. So the skills, I'm afraid, do not come naturally, but I can now easily transfer them. I talk about it in the book. I can't quite transfer it totally in the book, but I can teach about it and teach the whole underlying decision issue, the whole underlying change issue that has to get managed. And salespeople actually find it so helpful that sometimes they don't need the rest of the skill set. But it is learnable. I have to teach people how to listen for systems. I've invented a new form of question that teaches the brain how to bring together all the issues that they had not realized needed to be brought together so they could think about. I'll give you a little example. If I said to you, why do you wear your hair like that? that's me pulling data on a decision you've already made. But if I said, how would you know if it were time to reconsider your hairstyle? I am now causing you to think about all the issues you need to take into account as you make a new decision.
That's a definite difference in that kind of question. So how would we know if it would be appropriate for us to buy this book?
If you're not closing sales in a timely way, especially these days, I have a client that just went from a one-year sales cycle with a four-visit close to a three-week close with no visits. Because the time it takes buyers to come up with their own answers is the length of the sales cycle. Before they buy, they have to manage buy-in internally, and the sales model doesn't help. So I can reduce sales cycles. We get about an 800% increase. Remember, it's not sales, so we have it's a different equation and a different result. You would be getting more prospects. You'd be getting rid of the prospects that don't work out. You'd be getting rid of them immediately. You'd be differentiating yourself from the competition, and you would have no price objections, no any kind of objections, actually. Plus, it's a fun book.
Now, Sharon Drew, I've been coached most of my career, and I've been fortunate enough to make a little bit of a living through selling, but I've been coached most of my career to focus on the buyer's needs and then tie my solutions to those needs. But you're saying it's got to go beyond that, and you've got to get your arms around these internal choices. Can you say more about that?
Sales, unfortunately for all of us, especially salespeople who work so hard like you and me, sales manages only the solution placement end. And there has been an assumption that if we understand the need for ever so professional and delightfully charming, and it fits with the buyer's, if our solution is appropriate to fit with the buyer's needs, then they'll know how to buy. What we've never understood is what the buyer has to do when they go offline. So they have a fight with their boss, and they're not talking with the other department, and then the new partner comes in with a partial solution, and then the tech team wants to take over. We can't get involved with the internal politics or with those internal private discussions. We don't know about the history that's gone on before us. We sit and wait. We sit and wait and hope. And when it's time for us to play solution, you're exactly right. You've got just the skills to do that. But we've never had the tools to help the buyers manage those pesky discussions they have in their interdepartmental meetings when there's an agreement to use the old vendor.
Now, this is not your first rodeo. You've had a best-selling book out there before, am I right?
I've had a few. I had a New York Times bestseller with Selling with Integrity. This is my seventh book on this topic, not quite to the extent this one is, but yes, I've written a few books.
Well, you've talked a great deal about decision facilitation throughout your career, and I know I'm beginning to hear that term more and more in the marketplace. How does it feel to hear other people using that term and trying to apply it to their work? What's that like?
Somebody just wrote me a note thanking me for being the most important asset that the sales field has had for the past 20 years. I'm not sure that's totally true, but it sure made me happy. There's some things about it that are quite exciting, and there's some that are disconcerting. I have actually registered, trademarked the term buying facilitation, and I'm seeing people begin to use it as a way of manipulating a sale better and not managing the internal issues. They're using it on the sales end rather than the buying decision end. So that part is a little bit scary, because if the term is going to get in, I'd rather get it in right. But the decision facilitation, the buyer's decision, the buying phases, all that stuff is work I've been doing for 23 years. And I'm relieved, because I thought I was going to die and it wouldn't have happened, and it would happen while I was rolling around in my grave. So I'm really relieved and very excited. Thank you.
Well, one of the reasons that I asked you about your history with producing best-selling books, you know, a lot of our listeners, Sharon Drew, are aspiring authors. And I wonder if you have any words of advice for aspiring authors.
Wow. Somebody just wrote me and asked me how I got on, how I made a bestseller all by myself without a publishing house behind me, because this particular book I self-published, I wanted it out real quick. What I did was I wrote half of the day and I did marketing half the day. if you want a publisher, a publishing house, don't write anything except two chapters. before you get a contract. I found it relatively easy to self-publish because of the internet. I sent everybody chapters as I was writing them and got feedback from 100 people and maybe 15 different areas of business because I didn't want to just stay in sales. And I had a very specific way of getting their buy-in and having them read to help with their thinking, oh, this doesn't work, I don't understand this, thank you very much. And then I, on my blog, I pay-forwarded. I found the people that I wanted to help me a lot and wrote fabulous blogs about them. And then they called and said, oh, thank you, how can I help? And I went, oh, let me see. So I got a team together of mutual support, respect, and love as I was writing the book. And by the time I was done, everybody blogged and tweeted and was delighted to help. And obviously, we were successful.
Sharon Drew, it's Todd. A lot of the authors that we come across, they believe it's a if you write it, they will come scenario. And so you mentioned that you blog and that you've used some other social media. Isn't that the new way you market a book? I mean, your book's already a bestseller on Amazon. That didn't just happen.
No. One of the other things I did was I had a big fight with Amazon. They were getting orders weeks in advance, and they wanted to release it. And I said, no. So I wouldn't let them release it till October 15th. And then for the 2 weeks before, everyone I knew had to blog and tweet and blog and tweet and review and blog and tweet. And I was on everybody's neck constantly with my poor friends. And so when they said, okay, it's today, the floodgates broke and everybody was waiting for that day. And I had this huge rise in sales. And it doesn't sell by itself. I'm using Book Surge to print the book and get it out on Amazon. They're Amazon's right arm. I'm also using Lightning Source because Book Surge currently doesn't manage books overseas, and I have a big audience overseas. Lightning Source gets into Barnes & Noble and gets into the stores. And Book Surge mainly works with Amazon and the internet sites. So you can really handle distribution yourself, but you not yourself. I mean, you've got to pull all the strings. But for the past few weeks, I have been doing nothing but marketing 15 hours a day, emailing people, asking people, begging people, helping people, supporting people, serving people, writing other book reviews for people so they'll write one for me. That's all I've been doing, guest blogging nonstop. And I'm stopping just a little bit now that we're doing really well. But it, you know, even if a publisher publishes the book, you still have to do that because there's so many books out there. There's 70,000 titles a year that come out just in book form. Forget the online books. And if you don't do that, there's such a fight for mind share that there's no way to place it.
You can grab your own piece of the market by getting out there and building community around the principles of the book. It just amazes me how many authors who are most of them self-published, they don't just because they have a sell page on their website, they think that the book's going to sell. And it just amazes me.
I have something that happened over the weekend. A person that I know who wrote a book, she's not a friend, but she's a new colleague. She's had a book out there for a few months, and her publisher is annoyed with her because she's not doing anything, and she's a new author and was waiting for them to do it, which they do not do unless you're Stephen King or Stephen Covey. And what's interesting is that along my journey and my blogs, I have been discussing what I'm doing and how tired I am. One, I was really mad at my team, and I said that my proofreader should have had his fingers chopped off. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I said, I can't say that in the blog. And so I'm a Buddhist. And so I got up to change it. And I said, what do I really want to say? Oh, I want him dead. Oh, I want him to die. Oh, I want to kill him. So I put back that he should have his fingers chopped off. So I was so tired. And later on I said, I was so exhausted from all of this. So I let people follow my journey. And by the way, I was getting emails back from people saying, you need a vacation, dude. So I was so I put it out in the public. I believe that all of us should be putting our journeys in public so that we can all learn from each other. But this woman never bothered to go on to my site, my blog, and read my whole journey of how I did the marketing, which I laid out. It's all there. It's all there. So if anybody needs help with marketing and doesn't mind a few chopped off fingers and a very tired, soggy brain, go on to SharonDrewMorgan.com. That's my blog, and you can. I talk about other things as well, but every once in a while I do a very tired person journey on marketing a book.
Sharon Drew, we're just about out of time, but I want to make sure that our listeners do know how to get to you. So it's SharonDrewMorgan.com.
Yes, M-O-R-G-E-N. Yes, and then the book URL is DirtyLittleSecretsBook.com. But I have for you, you said I have to give you one mistake I made.
You certainly do. We would really appreciate it if you would share with our audience a mistake you've made at some point in your career.
When I was starting out, I decided that because I had a new sales paradigm, which I do, that the only way to get people interested was if I really provoked them into thinking that what they were doing was wrong so that obviously I could be right. I mean, right? So I would call people and I would say, using the beginning of my model, so how are you currently bringing new paradigm thinking to your sales folks? And they all said, oh, we're using Spin, Sandler, Richardson, whatever. And I would say, you think that's a new paradigm? That was a little bit of a mistake. People were hanging up on me.
That didn't work so well for you,
huh? No, it didn't work so well. And then I realized that my job wasn't to provoke but to serve. So it taught me a lesson.
Well, I think it's obviously been a fruitful lesson, and you're certainly enjoying a great deal of success, and rightly so. And for what it's worth, you have accomplished a great deal of teaching this morning. Our other guests that are here live in the studio have been writing furiously during the entire interview. Sharon Drew, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on. We'd love to have you back on sometime.
I'm here, Stone. Okay. And Todd. Thank you both.
Thank you, Sharon Drew.
Have
bye-bye.
A great day.
Bye.
Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, Todd, who do we have next?
We've got Brian Hilliard. Brian is a networking pro. He's a marketing guru. He's a speaker, trainer. He travels the country. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and a little about your company.
Well, as you said, my name is Brian Hilliard, and I'm the owner and resident marketing guy with Achito Consulting. And, you know, one of the things that we really try to do is to develop a strategy or a game plan for individuals on how they can best market themselves. And, you know, we've been fortunate to be able to do that for the past few years, actually started right after 9/11, and had the chance to be able to work with a number of different people.
So you're a person who tours the country for a living. You talk about sales, marketing, different ways to get the word out about your business. Mm-hmm. What have you seen over the past few months that's really changed in the world of marketing that might have an impact for our listeners?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that as salespeople, I think we're met with a high degree of consumer skepticism, right? You know, you used to be 10, 15 years ago, and you watch kind of like the AMC channel or whatever on cable, and you see these people who, you know, you say something, and it actually, what you said you were going to do was what you did. But, you know, now it's almost like everyone has become so skeptical of what it is that everyone else is saying. You know, it's kind of like we were watching, my wife and I were watching DirecTV, and they said, you know, that we're going to give you the this package for that, and if you sign this person up, you'll get it for free and this, that, and the other. Well, we signed up my mother-in-law, and we actually got the money. We were surprised. You know,
right.
We don't know any of these people, but we're surprised that actually what happened, what they said they were going to do actually happened. And I think as a individual, as an entrepreneur, franchise owner, whatever the case may be, I think trying to address some of the issues that people have in terms of the skepticism that's out there, as well as getting to a point where they actually believe what you're saying so that you can be a credible person, I think that's one of the issues that's going on right now.
Well, it's a fascinating concept. What do you suppose caused that skepticism in the marketplace?
That's a good question. I think a number of things. You know, obviously at the tail end, you have that whole deal with, we'll say companies unnamed, since I don't want to get into a suit or anything like that. But, you know, you had the whole stock market thing, with those companies. There was one obviously down in Houston. There was a big deal. You've got a number of different companies that kind of, I think it's fair to say maybe defaulted a little bit on the shareholders. So you had some leaders who we were looking at and didn't really get a chance to, didn't do what they said they were going to do. You've got other people, you've got salespeople, hopefully not you and I, but other salespeople out there who will do anything to get a sale, okay, say anything to get a sale. And at the end of the day, you have an environment where, you know, unless you got so much fine print, I saw a billboard the other day that says we're going to be offering really free checking. Okay. So I thought it was just free checking, but apparently these guys are telling us that it's really free checking. So, you know, you got these different dynamics, and I don't know exactly when it happened, Todd, but I think certainly over the last 10 years, we have entered an environment where at the end of the day, people just don't believe us.
See, I think the delivery of certain marketing tactics have soured people. I think spam, interruption marketing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it used to be how you do it, but I think that's had a big impact on changing people's attitudes towards advertising.
Well, Brian, you made it on our screen, as you know, because you have such a marvelous reputation in the Atlanta marketplace, and I know you do nationwide.
Yeah.
And I know you're out there directly consulting with a great many entrepreneurs, business owners. What kind of challenges are you seeing them face right now? Are you picking up some themes?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I work with a lot of financial advisors. I work with franchise owners. And just in particular, you know, I'm working with this one group, Jim Cook, over at National Financial Services Group. They do financial advisors. And one of the things, you know, when working with that particular industry is the idea that as an advisor, you're talking about insurance. Right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about the things that people don't want to hear about.
Right.
Death, taxes, how you can kind of get around some of those things. And what I found is that people are really good at what they're good at. All right. They're good at, if I'm sitting down with you, they're good at being able to say, all right, here's the program. Here's how it works. Bang, 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 bang. What I found is that individuals, and this transcends the financial services industry, we just happen to be talking about it right now, is that what they're not so great at is letting people know about it. What they're not so great at is being able to have a process for networking when they go out and meet people. One of the things, and I've written a book as well, it's called Networking Like a Pro. And one of the things that I talk about in there is creating this idea of a visible identity, where when you're going out and meeting individuals, you're meeting them, you're asking some of the right questions, you're engaging them so that they remember you after the fact, so that when you do follow up with them, they know who the heck you are, and you're not kind of on the phone, you know, I was the guy in the brown jacket. No, you don't want, if you find yourself going down that road, then you probably haven't done it right. So that's one of the challenges that I've seen out there.
I was watching the video on your website, and you made the point that one of the things that most people don't do when they're networking is the follow-up.
Oh, gosh. You know, if I had a dime, not even a dollar, if I had a dime for every person that went out and networked and didn't really follow up, you know, and here's the problem, all right? What the problem is we've been led, we're talking about society. A lot of the times people have been led to believe, you, Todd, talked about interruption marketing. Okay, so what people think is I go out, I do this deal, and I'm going to network, and I'm going to get a bunch of leads. Okay, I'm going to go down to the chamber and get a bunch of business. And I'm going to go down and right? And handing out cards and handing out brochures and this, that, and the other. And really what happens is all you've done is increase your exposure. Mm-hmm. All right? And there's this perception that marketing and exposure are one and the same. You know, like if I meet a bunch of new people, then all of a sudden that's going to somehow magically get me business. And what I tell people is, you know, if you want exposure, here's what you need to do. All right. First of all, give me a call and I'll hire out my dog. Okay. And what we're going to do is we're going to get my dog and we're going to put a little like tassel on him. Okay. We're on one side, like with a horse. All right.
Right.
There's a take my business card holder on the right hand side. There's an empty space where it says leave a business card. And what I'll do is I'll push him into the room. Okay. And after an hour and a half, I guarantee you'll have business cards in there. All right. But is that really going to be what you need to do in order to get more business? Probably not. So when I kind of make fun of it a little bit like that, people are a little bit more open to the message.
That's a great visual. So you're standing in the middle of a room,
yeah,
and several of them are presumably prospective clients.
Correct.
Or maybe even alliances you should make. How do you strike up the conversation? Are there, what should you say? What should you not say?
Right. One of the things that you definitely want to say is you want to be developing, like I said, a visible identity. Okay, mm-hmm. We touched on that. Part of it is you want to be asking the right questions. Okay, so like one of the people I work with, his name is Ashby Green. I work with the Trade Bank Atlanta people down here, and that's a bartering company. And they're going out and talking and engaging people at network events, so literally everyone could be their client. So,
right.
So what I say to them is, listen, here's what you want to do, Ashby. You want to go ask questions of people. Ask them, where else do they normally network? Ask them, what do they like best about what they do? Ask them, what got them started in that direction? We know people are going to ask you what you do, right?
Right.
They always ask you what you do. So if you can have something that kind of gives you a little bit of back and forth, now you've gotten into a dialogue. And that's really the point. Networking should be a dialogue. It should be the beginning of a relationship. It really should be a staging area that allows you to be able to open that dialogue so that you can have a future professional relationship.
See, that's the whole thing. We talked about interruption marketing. Marketing now is a dialogue. And that's why social media is so powerful.
Right, right.
Well, and I believe everything he's describing here, to me, it makes sense that it would apply in the social media world, right? You follow those same disciplines when you're interacting in social media, yeah?
Being on Twitter is like networking. It's just online.
That's exactly right. Because what do they say? What they say in social networking is not to come across as the used car salesman. They say don't come across as just kind of hitting people over the head. Instead, what they say is develop a rapport, get a relationship, add value, right? And then from there, you can ask or not ask for whatever it is you need.
Well, you know, Brian, every third person that I meet has some vision, some idea that they want to be a speaker. How did you pull this off? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
That's totally fine. Well, first of all, my mom is a motivational speaker.
Really?
Yeah, her name is Vera Hilliard, and she talks a lot with positive parenting, talks a lot with self-help, obviously, change management, a lot of things where single-parent moms and things like that. My parents live up in New Jersey. And one of the things that I learned early on was that these presentations don't sell themselves. Right? You got to be able to have a value proposition that people understand and they want. And then from there, you need to be able to articulate it in a language that they understand. A lot of the things that I'm actually doing today, my mom, my very first proposal, I worked with my mom for 9 months. I still use the basic template for that proposal. So, you know, there's different, even titles, you know, we've got CDs and stuff out there. Our flagship program is called How to Market Your Business in Less Than 90 Days. Okay. And one of the things that actually was from a title that my mom put together. Then I kind of spun off it. And the great thing about having your mom in the business is you don't have to pay any royalties.
Right.
You can invite her down and it's okay. So that's kind of how I got that started.
Well, yeah, tell us a little bit more about your speaking and your consulting work. What kinds of things are you teaching?
Well, what I do, the program is How to Market Your Business in Less Than 90 Days. And what I found is my philosophy is predicated on 12 unique marketing tools. You've got networking, which we've talked about, direct mail, trade shows, referrals. These are 12 different ways to kind of get the word out about your business. Mm-hmm. And what I found was people knew more about what not to do than what to do. And they would always say, I need to kind of market more. You know, I need to get more business and I need to market more. And nobody really had a clear understanding as to what that meant. So what I did was I said, here are these tools. And what we want to do is based on your target markets, I call those spheres of influence, based on those target markets, let's find 3 or 4 or 5 of these tools that work best for you and put them together into a marketing plan. And what I always tell people is this, marketing your business is not hard. Putting together a calculus equation. I don't know about you guys; are probably pretty smart. I you know, if you put a
well,
calculus,
they didn't let me in calculus. I had varsity sports, but that's okay. I think I could follow the example.
The idea is that if you gave me a calculus equation right now, I probably wouldn't be able to solve it, and I could take you could walk me through it, and 3 days later, I still wouldn't be able to do it. but that's hard, right? And what I try to tell people is, marketing is easy, not fall off your chair easy. Right. But once I show you how to do it, or anybody, I guess, but once I show you how to do it, it's being able to say, all right, so we know here's our markets. We know that here's our unique selling proposition. We haven't talked about that, but that's simply telling people what you do in a manner that gets them to ask how you do it. So if you had somebody like a financial advisor or whatever, you don't say I'm an advisor. You don't say I'm a banker. You say, you know, what you do with this person and how you help them get that ultimate benefit. And then from there, you apply some of these different marketing tools to it. And I like a 90-day program because I think that we live in an environment where that's a manageable amount, 90 days.
Right.
And you can kind of see yourself working on it. And that's kind of how we do it.
You mentioned direct mail. Do you think direct mail still works?
Great question. Okay, let me change the premise. Do I think direct mail works in terms of doing things? Yes. Do I think direct mail works in the traditional sense for getting business right over the top like it used to be in the 70s? No. I think direct mail is something where, like just for sake of discussion, let's say you're a real estate agent, okay, and maybe you want to do a direct mail piece at one of your target markets as first-time homebuyers. We're just making this up.
Mm-hmm.
So you might do a direct mail piece out to an apartment complex, but instead of saying, I'm Sally Agent, Sally Sue two agent, number one agent in town, what you might say is, tired of renting your home, you know, tired of throwing money out to the landlord, email sally@sallysueagent.com for a free report on the top five things you need to know before you get your first home. See, now I think that is effective. And then that way you can develop a database and be able to do some different things. And then that shifts into the online marketing, which is email and things like that, which is another component. But yeah, I think direct mail is changed, but I think when you make that adjustment, it can work.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I have a background in direct response as well. And it just fascinates me that people are just now saying, oh, direct mail is bad, 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 bad. But mail keeps going up every year and more people are doing it. And it just has to be integrated into your overall program.
That's exactly right. And what happens is people, I think, have looked at direct mail and they thought it was this kind of one-stop, ooh, I'm going to say, like networking. Oh, I'm going to say, I need some leads. Okay, well, let me go to the post office and get 1,000 things and mail it off and, you know, ooh, the ring, 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 and the phone starts ringing. That's just not how it works.
As many organizations as you're working with, I got to believe you've got enough data points to answer this next question.
Okay.
But what do you find most fun about your work, and what do you find, if anything, a little bit frustrating?
You know, that's interesting. We'll start with the good stuff first. I think the most fun is actually seeing people incorporate some of the things that we talk about and seeing how it impacts their life and their work. A lot of times, like I said, I work with advisors, I work with franchise owners, I work with business owners, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is you're talking about someone, and you guys know this just as well as I do, it is the biggest difference between being in a corporation, well, there's a lot, but the biggest difference between being in a corporation and being an entrepreneur is that a corporation, it's an interesting business discussion about sales and marketing. An entrepreneur, it's whether I'm going to pay my mortgage next month.
Yeah, if I don't produce, I don't eat.
There is simply, and it's not funny, actually. There's simply, you know, there's no discussion on that. And I think the biggest thing that I find is having it when people are able to see that, you know, I get a call a month or two later and they say, oh boy, you know, because we do a lot of coaching over the phone. And one of the things I tell people up front is your business today is a reflection of what you did 2 months ago. And that's confusing, but your business, right. So what you do today is actually going to be pushed out 2 to 3 months forward. So 2 to 3 months later, people, you know, they're, oh man, I used that networking and then I did this email and it worked. Okay. You know, and I'm trying to wait for what the punchline is. No, it worked though. I'm like, right. So one of the things that I really find most satisfying is when people actually are incorporating some of this stuff, and then seeing it work in their practice or their business. And then on the flip side, sometimes I won't use the word frustrating. I'll use the word disappointing if I can. Mm-hmm. What I find disappointing is seeing what you're talking about as an entrepreneur, generally speaking, is the degree to which the business grows is directly commensurate with their ability to get out of their own comfort zone. All right. So if people are trying to stay, sometimes people try to stay in their comfort zone while still growing their business. And it doesn't work like that. You have to grow in order for your business to grow. And what's disappointing is when I have dialogue with people and I don't see that happen as fast as I'd like.
How do you approach this this challenge of competition? I mean, let's face it. There are a lot of people out there in the speaking business. There's a lot of folks that say, well, we can help you with your with your marketing.
Right.
What do you do to differentiate yourself? How do you approach the whole competition thing?
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that, Stone. I was on the phone with a guy. He's a general agent, which is what they call the president of the financial world, one of the agencies. And his first question was, you know, sometimes you can tell by the tone. Well, you know, Brian, I've got so-and-so on the phone here, and he's been working with coaches for, you know, since 1912. And I want to know what makes you different. And, you know, I used to, you know, I've been doing this for about 8 years. I used to kind of get my ruffle, you know, my feathers, I get all my hackles up, you know, like a cat or something like that. You see the little tail go up. And then I just said, well, you know what? Let me tell you what I think we do that's a little bit different is we provide people some tools that they can actually see. We provide people some processes that they can actually understand. We provide people some techniques that they can actually use. You know, I think a lot of the things, one of the taglines we had is coaching for the real world. You know, and the idea, I think that speaks for itself. The idea is that if you want to have some type of interesting discussion about how the state of affairs works and whatever the business is that you're in, that's fine. And maybe I'm that person if we go have a beer or something like that, but I'm trying to really be vested in trying to help them grow their business. And one of my clients actually said this, and unsolicited, he said, you know, one of the things I think makes Brian different is that I get the feeling that he's just as vested into my business as I am. And I never thought about it that way, but boy, I'll tell you what, it's like I'm a big sports guy. I just love winning. And whether it's me or watching other people, I love it. So I like working with people to help them win.
And once a client genuinely believes that, then you can really help them.
Oh, it's almost, I won't say a slam dunk, but it's certainly something where people have to understand and buy in to the fact that you can help them and what you're trying to do. And then when they do that, yeah, I tell people it's like shooting free throws. You're kind of surprised when it doesn't go in.
Right. What a great line. How can our listeners get to your book, and how can they find out more about you and your services?
That's awesome. What we do is we have our website. It's www.agitoconsulting.com. That's A as in Apple, G as in George, IT as in Tom, O, consulting.com. My name is Brian Hilliard, and we've got the office line, if I can throw that out there.
Oh, yeah, please.
Is 678-313-5601. That's here on the East Coast, so we don't want any 5 a.m. calls from you West Coast people.
I've got to ask. I have another question that I want to wrap our time together with today, but now I've got to ask. Agito, does that mean something?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, you know, it's funny. Agito is the Latin term. It means to agitate, and it's the derivative for that.
We should be using that, Todd.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, the funny story is behind that. I don't know if you remember, back in 2001, the Dr. Craig Vedder was doing the race for the human genome. And I was watching the thing on CNBC, and they said, well, how is it that you got the name of the company? His name is Celera. And apparently, and I don't know if this is true, but let's take his word for it, it meant speed, because he was racing with another company. And I was watching MSNBC, and I'm like, ooh, that's cool. So I went to the internet, you know, I'm looking at the Latin right. American dictionary and went all about it, and that's how we got it.
Oh, that is very cool. Well, listen, before we let you go, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show.
Okay.
We like to ask each guest if they would to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really, more importantly, what they feel like they learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm reading Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and he's got the third investment on that, and it's called Rich Dad, Poor Dad's Guide to Investing. And one of the things that Kiyosaki talks about is that one of the difference between corporate America and entrepreneurs is corporate America views mistakes as like something to be avoided. You know, I don't want to do this. Whereas entrepreneurs, at least according to the rich dad perspective, viewed a mistake as a learning experience. So I'm going to kind of reframe the question, if I can, in terms of what was I able to find as a learning experience that was facilitated maybe by a misstep. And I think one of the biggest things was when we were starting out, when we were getting going, I thought that everyone wanted to be successful. I thought it was just me unlocking, working with, somehow figuring out what I can do to make them be more successful. But I thought everyone actually had a genuine desire to be more successful. Turns out I was wrong. Everyone actually wants to stay comfortable. To the degree that that success comes, they're okay with it, right? But there is a population out there who really, when brass tacks, would choose staying in their comfort zone versus being successful, however you might define that, growing your business or whatever the case may be. And one of the biggest things I had to make in terms of going forward was realizing, listen, when you're talking with people, one of the mistakes I had was working with the wrong people. So I had to make sure that I was at the front end getting the people who I felt would be most likely to be successful with me.
What an insightful comment.
It's so true, though, isn't it? It's why people are willing to be stuck in those cubicles.
What a great interview. I am so glad that you invested the time to come down to the studio today, Brian.
Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, it was our pleasure. Can you hang out with us for a little while?
Absolutely.
While we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
Terrific. Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, I am delighted to introduce to you Dr. Fred Broder. He's the author of Does Your Life Need a Laxative? He's a speaker. He's got a great deal of things to share with us, and I've got a ton of questions. Welcome to the show, Fred.
Well, Stone, I'm just thrilled to be here.
What compelled you to write this book, and what compelled you to write it now?
Well, I think it was really an outgrowth of all my consulting and speaking work, and it was not unusual for people to come up after I did a presentation. They say, do you have a book? Do you have some tapes? Do you have something that I can take with me to further think about and learn some of the principles that you shared with me? And initially my answer was no, but I'm working on it. And I was working on it, never doing it, and violating the very principles that I was advocating to other people, because writing a book was one of my goals. And as a matter of fact, I finally one day said, you know, there's a market for this. I have a goal written down that I've never followed through on, so I think it's time to write the book. And that led me down to my basement where I was started to do some house cleaning. And I found a folder from 1986. And I opened it up, and the title was, Does Your Life Need a Laxative? And it was a bunch of handwritten notes of a book I started in 1986. Now, at that time, I didn't have the word processor, and so if it wasn't for that, and I couldn't deny that that was my handwriting, I would have said as I started to read it, who wrote this stuff? It doesn't sound like me. I don't remember writing it. But, boy, you know, some of this stuff makes sense. Of course, I've grown a little bit. I've had some more insights. And so I took those rough notes, and I went and I rolled up my sleeves and I began to write the book. Sometimes people, by the way, ask me about that title.
Yeah, I was about to. Yeah. How in the world?
You need a new title. It's boring as cardboard.
And that title is really a two-edged sword. People say, well, you know, where did you come up with the title, Does Your Life Need a Laxative? Dr. Fred's Practical Prescriptions for Happiness. And my glib answer is I once saw a bumper sticker that said, eat a prune and start a movement. And I tell them that I'm, you know, here to start a movement to help you purge, cleanse, and expel from your behavior repertoire, from your attitudinal repertoire, those behaviors and those attitudes that are counterproductive and basically sabotage the very things you want in life. But the truth of the matter is, and some of the previous guests have talked about marketing, you have to get people in the tent. And you need something to pull them in. And when you're writing a book, there's no denying that the title is the hook. And regardless of what's between the pages in terms of the wisdom or lack of wisdom, you want people to take it off the shelf. You want them to open it up. You want them to read it. And so that anyway, that's where Does Your Life Need a Laxative as a provocative title came about. Now, has it caused me some weird, uncomfortable situations? Yes. I was in the Atlanta airport, and I had the book, and a lady happened to see the title, and she came running up to me, and she said, I need that book. I need that book. Where can I get it? And I said, well, you know, Barnes & Noble's, Amazon, whatever. She said, let me tell you. She said, I have a bowel obstruction. And I need your book. Now, and this is a true story. And now, you know, we talk about sales and we talk about ethics. There was my ethical moment. Do I sell the book or do I tell her the truth? Obviously, I told her the truth that was not what she needed. One other, you know, quick example, and then we'll get off the title. I was working on the Queen Mary II cruise ship as a speaker, and this British gentleman with the ascot and the blue blazer, he and his wife were there, and he had looked at the title of my book, and he said to his wife, Mary, Mary, this man's written a book, Does Your Life Need a Laxative? Now, she had, unfortunately, a hearing problem, and she thought he said, Does Your Wife Need a Laxative? So she became very indignant, very upset with him, started to turn her anger towards me, and, of course, we had to settle the fact that that was not the actual title.
So apart from the title, how is your book different than all the other self-improvement books that are out in the market?
Well, I think it really reflects my philosophy, which is there's really nothing very new that's come off of Mount Sinai lately. And I'm not somebody who tries to suggest that I have come up with some new piece of wisdom that no one has ever heard or thought of. I rather take the role of somebody who's here to help remind you and help you to review and revisit things that you know, things that you probably advise other people to do when they're in a jam, but you may or may not be applying it yourself in your own life. So the book was designed to be a very easy read. There are 29 chapters, no chapters longer than 5 or 6 pages, and each chapter stands on its own. So you don't have to read the book in order. You can peruse the table of contents, and the chapters have, you know, some – at least I tried to give them some provocative, unusual titles like Do You Still Ride the Merry-Go-Round? You're Never Too Old for Your Blankie? Life is a Garage Sale?
this guy is creative,
you know,
isn't he?
Reading Your Dashboard of Life? Are You Still Willing to Milk a Cow? And basically what I've tried to do in those 5 or 6 pages in each chapter is to use an analogy, something that people can relate to, something that's not hard to figure out or deep, but it brings home a point, a principle of life, a principle about relationships, and an idea of how you can move your life more in the direction that you would like to move it.
I get the sense it's more about storytelling than it is just straight therapy.
Storytelling, the stories are a vehicle to make a point, and not every chapter is in a sense telling a story, but every chapter is designed to use the cliche, I'm here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. It's to shake you out of your to shake you out of your complacency. The assumption is if you chose to read the book, then you have some level of interest in moving your life in a direction above and beyond where it is right now.
We got a theme going today, Stone. I mean, our last guest, Brian, was talking about people being complacent and not willing
comfort to – comfort busters. We got to have a round table of comfort busters.
I tell you, I think it's a brilliant idea because I think that's what – I think that's a big problem in the world today is people are just afraid. There's just so much fear.
Yeah. So when you're not in the basement cranking out catchy titles or out in the world pissing off old people, I understand you also do quite a bit of speaking and training, and you do this in some very interesting venues. Can you say a little bit more about that, if you will?
Well, in addition to being a keynote speaker for corporations, associations, and doing a lot of sales management and customer service training for companies, three or four times a year, I'm invited by various cruise lines to be a guest speaker on their cruise ships. And obviously, that is a very enjoyable opportunity. And I've been doing that for the last 7 years. As a matter of fact, I'm scheduled over Christmas and New Year's to work on Celebrity Cruise Lines in South America. And I know I'm not going to get any sympathy, and I seldom do when people ask me about that.
Well, there's phase two of the interview. We'll just probably do it there.
Exactly. Good call. Well, as is so often the case with guests that come into our studio, we talk to a lot of very successful people, and I know so many of our listeners, they want that pearl. What is it that has made you so successful? There are a couple of disciplines, a couple of ideas, a philosophy that has helped you achieve the success that you're enjoying.
Well, the cliche is first to define what you really want. And what is your definition of success? And I'm very cautious to suggest that it's always consistent with padding your bank account and having a bigger car and a bigger house. For some people, that's what it is. I'm a great believer that the first and most important thing are your relationships. And what's really important in life are your relationships with the people who are important to you. And that a lot of times we sacrifice those relationships in pursuit of some other definition of success. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, but I think if you have to take one before the other, my vote is always for the relationships. And I think one of the reasons for my success is, and I won't say that this was always the case, but at this point in my life, I think I have my head screwed on straight. And in the sense that I know what my priorities are. And I'm very committed to those. And I think to be successful, you have to be committed. And you also, as was alluded to by some of the other speakers, Brian said this as well, is I think you have to be willing to pay the price and pay a price. And I remember when I first started out as a speaker, I started out as an educator, frankly. I had three careers. I was an educator for 15 years. I had all the titles, my doctorates in education. I worked for Atlanta City Schools for 8 years. I was a principal. I was a central office administrator. I was director of training for the State Education Association. I had all these titles. But I had this desire and aspiration to be a speaker and to do training and do that work. And at that time, I still am married, happily married to my wife, Glenda, for 36 years. And our three children were very young. And one day I decided to just walk away from education and go cold turkey as a speaker and trainer. And for the first 2 years, I literally, I guess to use the word starved, for want of a better term, I found out what it was like to go into a store and not be able to just pull anything off the shelf and not think about the cost. I watched my bank account and savings account dwindle. But I never veered away from my commitment and belief that I was on the right track, I would be successful, and that this was just part of the process. Of course, in doing this, I had the support of my wife and other people. And without that support, you really can't do it. By the third year, my income was equivalent to what I was making in education. And by the fourth year, I was ahead of the game. And so when I go out and work with people, it's not just from an intellectual basis of, in a cavalier way saying, this is what you should do and this is how you should do it. I can honestly, from an emotional and empathetic level, say that, I've lived it, and you have to decide what's important to you and is it worth paying a price and what price are you willing to pay? And sometimes if the answer is no, that's okay too. The only thing is don't go ahead and beat yourself up the rest of your life and feel guilty and feel frustrated because you, quote, didn't attain what you wanted. Look at it as you made a rational evaluation of what it was you thought you wanted, what it would cost you in terms of pursuing it, and you made a rational decision not to pursue it, and that's okay, and just be happy with where you are and enjoy the rest of your life.
I wonder if you'll help me make a bit of a connection here, because at least at first blush, the book seems like a really strong self-help book. And then I try to contrast that against, you know, I get the idea, given the venues where you speak and train, you know, your target prospect, your target client is not Jim Bob's taxidermy. I mean, you're working with large organizations. They're paying good money to have managers and salespeople attend your training. So how do you reconcile that? How is that book helping the corporate person, and what are they getting from your speaking and your training?
Well, Stone, you're absolutely right. The book is really an adjunct. The book is a prerequisite. The book is intended to set the table for anything else you want to do in life. As you suggested, you know, I work with Allstate Insurance, Cox Television, Kaiser Permanente, a variety of clients, where the objective is to help the managers manage better, the leaders lead better, and the salespeople sell more. So then the question is, well, where does the book come into play? My contention is that no matter what you do in life, if you don't have your personal life in order, if you're in a state of crisis, if you're in a state of distraction, if you're preoccupied, then you can't come into the venue, whatever that venue is in your professional career, and do what you're expected to do, do what you're capable of doing if you're preoccupied and distracted. So the first thing to do is to make sure that you purge, cleanse, and expel those things in your personal life that are detracting and distracting you from what you're there to do. So once we get that out of the way, then we can focus on the sales skills, the leadership management skills, whatever the case is we're working on.
If people could read only one chapter in the book, which one would you recommend to them?
You know, it's funny, like most authors, your book is your baby, and you think your baby is beautiful, and you think every feature of your baby is beautiful. You know, all 29 chapters are beautiful. And now you're saying, okay, which feature of your baby do you think is the nicest feature? And if I had to make a choice, I think it would be the chapter, Reading Your Dashboard of Life. And the reason for that, and this is a good example, it's indicative of the rest of the book in terms of how to take an analogy and try to use the analogy as a vehicle. We all, you know, most of us drive, or we've certainly been passengers, and we understand that every car has a dashboard, and that periodically lights go off on that dashboard, and the light may say oil or battery or engine. And as a rational person, if you're the driver or even if you're the passenger, you say, you know, I better get this car in to be looked at and taken care of and correct whatever's going wrong in the car, because I don't want to break down at 2 a.m. On some isolated street. So that's the rational thinking. Well, if you would look at your personal life and your professional life, your total life as a series of dashboards, you have a physical dashboard, you have a business dashboard, you have a personal dashboard, you have a social dashboard, you have a spiritual dashboard, and at various times in your life, lights are going off on each of those respective dashboards, trying to warn you, trying to alert you that something is not right. If you're starting to feel certain aches and pains in your chest, or you're having unusual headaches or whatever, those are lights going off saying, get to the doctor. If you find at home that you're having more arguments, less time that you want to spend together with your spouse or significant other, or less time that they want to spend with you, those are lights going off. There needs to be an intervention. If you're at work and you notice that you didn't get the bonus you expected, if you're not getting invited to internal meetings that you used to get invited to, if you didn't get the promotion that you expected, those are lights that are going off saying something's wrong. And in each of those examples, if you would look at those as dashboard lights, and if you would give them the same attention and the same response and the same respect that you would the lights on your car, then I think you'd find that you'd have a lot fewer breakdowns in those various dashboards, a lot fewer crises, and a lot happier moments in your life. So that chapter, to me, in a way, symbolizes so much of what the book is about, so much of what Fred Broder is about, and so much of what I try to advocate.
Where can we get our hands on this book?
Well, other than calling my mother, who's no,
she's got a couple hundred copies.
She's cornered the market. But beyond that, if you go to barnesandnobles.com, Barnes & Noble store, amazon.com, Varia Borders can order it. The book is out there and it's available. And as I said, the book is a true adjunct of what I'm really about, which is not only sending a message about how to live a happier life, given the fact that we really don't know how long any of us have here, and none of us want to check out, leaving a lot of unfinished business. But also, I spend so much of my time focusing on skill development, because you can have the greatest attitude in the world, but if you don't have the skill set to go with it, then you only have half the equation.
And how can our listeners get in touch with you and find out more about your speaking and consulting work?
Well, my website is www.fredbroder, that's B-R-O-D-E-R.com, www.fredbroder.com. My email address is fred@fredbroder.com, and my office number is 770-392-0382.
And before we wrap today, I wonder if you'll tell us very briefly about one of those times when one of those dash lights came on for you and you recognized a mistake that you made at some point in your career, and what you feel like you learned from it, how you got things turned around.
Well, when I finished my doctorate degree, I wanted to get certified in another area, so I went to real estate school because I wasn't up for law school or anything that would take too long, and I figured real estate school was doable. I got my real estate license, and then when I left education, I decided to run two careers concurrently. I tried to develop my speaking training business as well as sell commercial real estate. On hindsight, big mistake. When the phone rang, one minute I was talking acreage, and the next minute I was talking motivation. Mm. And the reason I was doing that at the time, and obviously it was not a good idea, was I saw real estate as the brass ring. You know, I was going to sell the big community, all that acreage, and bust out and be financially successful the rest of my life. Well, what I basically did was dilute my energies, dilute my efforts, and I really wasn't as good at either one as I should have been. Finally, I realized it, and I put all my focus into my speaking, sales, and management training business, gave up the real estate, and my recommendation to anyone out there is identify the one thing that's really important, focus on it, concentrate, and don't dilute your energies, because you might find that you'll have the experience I had.
It sounds like a valuable lesson. Achieve that focus. Oh, that's terrific. What a great show. I'm worn out, Todd.
Yeah, I'm exhausted.
with the Comfort Busters. That's what we'll have to name this episode.
The Comfort Busting episode, yes.
Yeah, and maybe I think we ought to have several of these folks back for you. It seems like we're building more and more of these roundtable episodes.
I think that'd be fascinating. I mean, I named my company Intrepid because I want my clients to be fearless.
Yeah, right.
So it's a common problem that I think cuts across all realms of people and industries and trades, and it's just fascinating to me.
Another hard day at the office, man.
Absolutely. Boy, it's tough work.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton, Sharon Drew Morgan, Brian Hilliard, Dr. Fred Broder, our producer Lee Cantor, and my buddy Todd Schnick saying we'll see you in the fast lane.